Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. It's like a dry forest after a lightning storm. Fires flare up here and there and here again. You think you've got one under control and bam, another area explodes. That's a pretty good description of the Middle East and parts of the northern rim of Africa right about now. Governments are raining bombs down on their own people. Are we seeing the end of freedom or its beginning? Let's talk with Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, about the Middle East. Lincoln, it's hard for me, sitting here in my comfortable and safe studio, to imagine the horror that's taking place on the other side of the world. Do you believe all of the turmoil is going to serve a greater purpose?
Well, yes, it serves a greater purpose. Speaking as someone who reads the Bible and Bible prophecy, it's all working toward a grand conclusion to reveal God fully when he comes, and to also reveal the evil force and its bad effects on history, which is sort of to dodge the question a bit, because none of us know absolutely what will happen next. But we need to look at what has happened a little in the past as a model, I think, to look at this. You know, while you were introducing the program, I was thinking about one of the experiences of my youth, and we never had television when I was growing up in Australia. Which sounds very
primeval.
Yeah, primeval. It was just that my parents didn't believe in television. They actually had it then. Yeah. Although black and white was the
color of the day, yes.
Yeah, but we didn't have it until we came to the U.S. I was a teenager, and then I ruined my sleep at night by watching old movies now and then. Yeah. And one of the old movies that I watched and that I remember the advertisements on the billboards when I was a kid was Lawrence of Arabia movie.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of the title of it. Sure. Just Lawrence of Arabia.
That's it. Lawrence of Arabia.
You know, that caught my imagination up here, the single English soldier, because that was back in the era. And remember, I was in Australia when the British were like gods on earth.
Yes.
At least they told people they were.
Exactly.
That they could you know, with a sweep of the hand, make countries, divide them up, rule them. You know, a couple of topi-clad generals could rule all of India with the teeming hundreds of millions. It was a bit of an illusion, really. I've read a lot more about Lawrence of Arabia, and I remember reading his book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and it was a very pivotal time. It's not the only time in history, and maybe later I can go back even further. But in the modern world, that's really when what we're seeing unravel now was shaped. In the aftermath of two wars, the great powers had an awful lot to do with dividing up the world, and in particular the Middle East. And it's not too long ago that in the United States, you know, we saw a whole contingent of young people go off and fight against Saddam Hussein twice.
Twice, exactly.
Gulf War One and Two. Yeah. The first one was very problematic to most people. Why did he want to get back or to even take over Kuwait? And very few people seem to understand that the British had set him up for that. They'd made the country of Iraq sort of out of a helping of other countries and then divided away from it a little spot on the coast where there were some British oil wells that they wanted special control of, and they put a local sultan over that. So, you know, we've inherited these high-handed actions. Remember, Egypt was ruled by the French and the British at one point, or if not directly, always through proxies. And these little Arab emirates along the coast, they were the different coaling stations for the British fleet. We're really looking still, even though we think we look at discrete countries of the Middle East, we're really looking at the ghosts of imperialism. And while Islam is the common factor in that part of the world, has been for many, many hundreds of years, I don't believe those societies truly have developed a clear national identity or an ongoing cultural history that they can draw on to sustain them adequately through some of the changes of the modern world. And my view is that we're seeing a revolutionary moment that was inevitable, and has been delayed somewhat because the big powers again have meddled. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had allies there like Mubarak and that we've enabled. And I don't believe Mubarak was the worst of the worst, but, you know, he was an autocratic guy in the old mold and really didn't truly allow the country to flourish as you might want. And so people after the imperialists, where they were kept down, treated like dirt, the overlords like Mubarak kept it up the same. And there's been stirrings underneath, you know, Twitter and YouTube and the internet and, you know, the whole thing has brought information to people who find it hard to come by, are living almost in not the Stone Age, but the pre-industrial age. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a revolution that's a social revolution that's bubbling up. Unfortunately, and this is really why we're talking about it on this program, while that can be explainable and is predictable and even ideal, there is a present religious agenda that is giving a wild card that may not work to the best for them and for the rest of the world.
Well, which came first, the social revolution or the religious revolution? Is which was driving? Is one driving the other? Let's put it that way.
Well, of course, that you can't easily say which is the horse and which is the cart.
Yeah.
But I do believe, and I'm not really a Marxist. You know, Karl Marx did believe, or was it Engels? But Marx and Engels, you know, brought up their philosophy, and they believed that because they tied into evolutionary viewpoints, which we don't buy into, but they applied evolution to the development of states, and that there was a natural progression from feudalism on through capitalism and democracy, and then communism. You know, I don't believe that at all, but we do know because it's happened to certain societies that they move from an agrarian culture, and the Industrial Revolution has brought people into the cities more, then the Information Revolution. We know what that produces, and it has not yet fully happened in that part of the world. So it's somewhat predictable what's to happen. And as we've often spoken on this program, some of the concepts that accompanied this greater education and industrial ease which it brought to people has positively informed people's yearning for freedom and self-determination and religious expression. So that good part of that is at play here. The bad part, I think, is not so much the religion, but it's a religion tied to an old social structure.
Interesting. In other words, the religion then becomes the boundary, the ties that keep it from rising to where it really should be going.
I'll get back to a refrain that I've sung a lot before, that Christianity in medieval Europe was in a very bad state, where the Roman Catholic Church had pretty much a monopoly on religion within Europe. It also had a monopoly on power because it had united with the secular power and it had them sort of blackmailed because the secular leaders could be excommunicated and threatened with a higher power if they didn't do what the church wanted. So you really had a very repressive and inflexible religious structure. As the social changes occurred, the move toward the cities and so on, and greater knowledge, there was a huge tension that built up with this old church. And that, in a nutshell, in my view, is the story of the Reformation. I mean, the theology was understanding the Bible more fully, but the shift was the old church tied to an old society, and it couldn't move quick enough. And it did not want to move case. Yeah. And I believe in the Middle East, we're seeing the same thing with Islam. You know, Islam has its own norms and its own particular problems and even perhaps strength. But clearly the Islam that's practiced in much of the Middle East is tied to a medieval society. And it has not shown an easy willingness to shift, or at least some radical elements of it. And I believe that there's going to be a reactionary effort to seize power in this shift.
So you're going to see, in your estimation, you're going to see that as these nations emerge, they're going to emerge as a religious political nation?
I think very likely. And the big test that we've all been watching, and now people have forgotten about it, is Turkey. You know, the Turkish Empire was actually the spearhead of Islamic expansionism for hundreds of years. And the Turkish expansion in the 1500s and through, I think, about 1600, was right up to the gates of Vienna. It even looking at, I've got a list here of some of the big battles. Like here, like just this is not just Turkey, but the Islamic attack on Europe started with the conquest of Spain in the 700s, the siege of Vienna in 1683. Vienna, Austria, was besieged by the Turks. There was the siege of Malta in 1565, the Battle of Lepanto, that was a naval battle between Islam and the West in 1571, and the siege of Vienna I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And it was turned back in Spain in some ways, but Turkey was usually the force. And it's rather ironic that because of a byproduct of, the great wars and the great power realignments and so on, Turkey was denatured from its Islamic model. And with Kemal Atatürk around World War One, around that period, a great general who had a secular image for Turkey. And by edict and force of personality, he turned it into a secular state. And today, Turkey is part of the NATO, North American Treaty Organization, and it's in the process of being joined into the European Union.
Right.
But it has a great conflict within it. It's not been settled in its society whether it's a secular or a religious state. And there's been great upwellings of late, and the radical Islamist part, well, maybe radical is the wrong word. The Islamist parties have basically seized the balance of power in the parliament, and they're well on their way, if not to being a Sharia republic, then being clearly what anyone would say is somewhat of a fundamentalist state. And that's the best case in the Middle East.
Well, you've got me worried now, Lincoln, because now instead of looking over there and seeing these revolutionaries and say, all right, they're fighting for freedom, they're fighting for their own rights and to stand on their own and to live their own lives, I suddenly see something a little more sinister beginning to emerge over there.
Well, sinister for us, but, you know, it's their own story. But it's not – I do not believe this is the Prague Spring or anything like that. What I think is this is a moment of optimism. People are just tired of the repression of being cut out of where the West of the world is heading. And so, yes, things are bubbling up. But I like how one website on the internet pointed it out. I mean, I could do the same thing, but it sounds more authoritative if I read somebody else's words. But K.T. McFarlane writing on a big-time conservative website. That's what it's called, the big-time conservative. And I don't always agree with conservatives, but this is just an analysis of history. And he says, all revolutions follow a pattern, a three-act play. First, reformers rise up to overthrow an autocratic dictator. He says, we've seen that in Egypt.
Check, yes.
Uh-huh. Second phase, the reformers try to govern, but they've never done it before, and they make mistakes. They struggle to create from whole cloth the institutions necessary for self-government. Once so united, the reformers soon start falling out amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
French Revolution followed that pattern.
Yes, yes.
The American Revolution followed that pattern. You know, the whole Federalist Papers deal and all the rest. People forget. And then the Civil War, even.
Oh, my.
Which was really the natural outgrowth of some deep-seated divisions that came from the very beginning. Yeah. Then Act 3, it says, if the reformers can pull together and hold some sort of free elections, they're on the way to self-government. If they don't, a minority group of well-organized, ruthless extremists will crush the liberal reformers and impose their own authoritarian government.
And there you are, back where you started.
Right.
Basically.
What he's really saying, even at the best of times, you will have a power struggle after the initial euphoria.
Yeah.
So just because the dictator in And what was the first country that went, I can't even remember it, Tunisia.
Tunisia, yeah.
In Tunisia, just because he takes to his plane and flies overseas, it's not over, it's just beginning.
Just beginning.
And actually, that the faction that replaces him is very likely to fall to different agendas, different groups that now then assert themselves individually, where before they were just all united in getting rid of the leader. And what we've seen in the years leading up to this is the steady and inexorable rise of radical fundamentalist rule proponents, mm-hmm. Sharia law. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, of course, it's the granddaddy of all the organizations, the Muslim Brotherhood. And people debate endlessly whether they're violent, and I think that's almost immaterial. What is absolutely proven with the Islamic Brotherhood, it's the ideological basis for all Sharia movements. It's in fact, it's most dangerous because it is a well-thought-out, systematic ideology that has influenced practically everybody in every Muslim country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their view is that religion should be in control of the government and in control of every element of someone's life. Mm. It's fine for them to say they want to bring it about by democratic means, and they may just have those means now presented to them. And I've said before, I think on this program, that even a year ago in Egypt, surveys showed that something like 80% of the populace said that they would support either a death penalty or severe legal penalties for those that try to change their religion. Well, that's indicative of a deep-seated Islamist viewpoint.
It certainly is.
So, you know, I hope it doesn't happen because it's not good for the people that live in those countries for their religious self-determination, and it will not be good for free interchange of ideas in the world and between the West and the Middle East, and it will not be good for freedom in the United States if they go that way, because we will just tighten up and perhaps in our mirror image overreaction, do something similar here.
Has there ever been a case of Lincoln Steed is with us. He's the editor of Liberty Magazine. We're talking about the emerging Middle East. Lincoln, has there ever been a case where the three act was just two acts? I mean, can we leave out the middle act ever in a country emerging? How about Russia? We've seen an emerging in Russia in the last couple of decades. How's that working out?
Well, you know, you mentioned Russia. The Russian Revolution was it 1918, somewhere around there. That was the classic one. There was a revolution along general revolutionary principles, but they were not the hardcore red communists. They were the white Russians that took over. Mm-hmm. But they ruled ineffectually, and the revolution was stolen from them by the Reds. And it went very doctrinaire Marxist. What I think you're referring to, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the breakdown of the Soviet Union into the different republics that had been kleptomanically added to Russia, as what it really was that Russia did bear the price in blood in getting rid of Hitler.
Yes.
You know, for all our talk of the greatest generation, it was the Russians that really defeated Hitler. That you got to thank them for, but what they did that was not so praiseworthy was they didn't, when they liberated the dominions that Germany had conquered, they then enforced communism on them. Mm-hmm. And they were all those countries. They were not really uniformly the same sort of communism, but they were people under ideological and sometimes even literal occupation. Mm-hmm. And so when in the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was the totemic act of the dissolution of that empire, then we saw democracy breaking out all over, as George Bush said. And I always felt that while that was wonderful, because it was all that you could hope for at that point, it probably was a prelude to very bad things, because there was such a euphoria of optimism that could not be sustained. People were bound to have their hopes dashed. And once the cynicism set in, then the less positive forces would take power. And we've seen in many of those countries the retrograde communists retook, they don't call themselves communists anymore, but the same faction took over. We've seen some seriously radical groups. And for religious freedom, very strangely, because very few people saw this coming, while communism was opposed to religion, we've seen the newly empowered Eastern Orthodox and sometimes Islamic forces in some of those republics turn on religious pluralism big time. And in some ways, they're more actively persecutory than it was under at least the final days of communism.
You know, I can't help but think, Lincoln, you are not only the editor of Liberty Magazine, you're also a pastor, a preacher, and a Christian. I see a parallel running here in the Christian experience. In a world of sin, we are occupied by the devil, and we have to overthrow the devil, and we find this euphoria of conversion. And what happens next is what separates those who are successful in their conversion and those who are not successful in their conversion. Have you seen that parallel in your experience as well? I mean, in the experience of others in your area?
Absolutely. And my wife always tells me this, not on Christianity, my wife tells me this on marriage, you know, that you have to work at something. Not just a moment where it happens, it's handed to you on a platter and that's it. And in the personal Christian life, there's a conversion experience and you shift from one way of living and thinking to a Christ-directed way of life.
Yeah.
But you have to do it. You have to walk that way. You know, even the hymn, which you got to take with a little salt, you know, Onward Christian Soldiers.
Yes.
And it's been said that the Christian life is a battle and a march.
That's right.
Not always so negative, because it could be a victorious battle. In fact, overall should be, but it's not without some reverses, because there's a pushing against anti-forces. Mm-hmm. And yes, this democracy that we're seeing, or in fact, I don't even think it represents itself as democracy. The word's hardly used, but this self-determination in the Middle East is good. You know, people that have been repressed have every right and reason to push against it. But, you know, unless they work consistently and calculatedly toward a more liberal, open system, it's just going to bounce from one trouble to the other. Mm-hmm. And I this is not determinative, but I'm duty-bound to say this as a Seventh-day Adventist. I've been very taken over the years by reading the words of Ellen White, who was a young woman early in the days of the Millerites, who became, some of them, Seventh-day Adventists. Mm-hmm. And she and her husband, James White, were pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But she had dreams and visions that while there was initial skepticism, many of the members came to be absolutely convinced that God was speaking through her. Well, she wrote many things where she said she'd been shown to illuminate biblical prophecy and what was going to happen. And a number of times she says something to the effect that at the very end of time, just before the Lord manifests himself in the skies as is promised, and most every Christian understands that imagery, she says that the scenes throughout the entire world will be like those of the French Revolution.
Mm.
And I think about that. And you know, I've got to bring some balance into that myself, because while this is cataclysmic at the moment, it's not the only moment. You and I were talking about the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. That was somewhat similar. And I'm old enough to remember the colonial euphoria and bloodletting that followed in Africa. When the colonialists pulled back, you know, the Mau Mau terror and all that sort of stuff, that was another dangerous moment. And the best I can say on what's happening in the Middle East now is that this is at least changing the status quo, which was not very good, and that it may give opportunity for certainly many individuals to rethink not just their political affiliation, but their religious affiliation. And to see that since everything's fading away and by the behavior of some of the religionists, that maybe there's something else going on. And they'll look around and make an individual choice rather than, so often happens in the Middle East and certainly even in Catholic countries, where someone is born to a religious identity, accepts it automatically, but never questions, never has the joy of spiritual discovery of their own. And so I do think that if God has a hand, I mean, God has his hand, but if we can say, looking at this, that God has his hand on it, it can be to enable the individual a chance to broaden their horizons, even if a given country does not absolutely arrive at a Greek democratic solution, classical democracy.
Right. I just love the fact that we worship that kind of God, the God who is waiting in the wings, the God who is there giving us the freedom we need and we require. Because, you know, freedom is best born in freedom. You have to clear the air, you have to clear the ground, the smoke has to clear so you can build freedom based on what you know to be right. And I love the fact that we have that kind of God. Lincoln, in the 2 minutes we have left here, can we give our listeners some encouragement as they face their own struggle personally to break free from the dictatorship of evil in their lives? What kind of encouragement can you give them to be like the nations of old and come out and gain the freedom that they want so much? What would they do?
Well, we need to question our style of living and thinking. Maybe we're in a rut. Maybe we haven't really look past the dictatorship of day-to-day events and the habits that we've established and realize that God wants us to be free. He wants us to be free to find him, to find happiness. And indeed, the only true freedom is in spiritual understanding. It's not to be found in democracy per se. It's not to be found in capitalism per se. In this part of the world, we know it's not to be found in communism or dictatorship. But all of these systems, good, bad, or indifferent, are not really the way to true fulfillment. It's spiritual communion and understanding with the divine mind. And that's what God has always called his people toward.
My. Beautiful, beautiful. Lincoln Steed, our time has flown by as it does every time I talk to you. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. Listener, www.libertymagazine.org. Go ahead and subscribe to this magazine. I recommend it to you and for people in your community, the thought leaders, the people who you know make decisions, need to have a clear understanding of these issues, and we invite you to provide them with Liberty Magazine. LibertyMagazine.org is where you can do that. Until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Lincoln Steed saying, may you rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone. You've been listening to Life Quest Liberty. To further explore the issues discussed on today's program, visit www.libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of religious freedom burning in your heart today.